Good evening. My name is Bob Lewis. I'm chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. It's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight and to thank you for your support. I also want to extend our gratitude to BMO Financial Group for their generous support of this series of talks. And I also want to thank Ipsos, our partner in polling, for their continuing contribution to the debate about the role of media in our lives. And you may have already seen the results of the survey they've just produced. It's interesting. It's an online survey, and it shows, generally speaking, that traditional media is still very strong, which is kind of interesting on a day when we find that Newsweek is going digital, and the BCE Astral deal isn't going anywhere. So it's been a big news day today. A short commercial break. We depend on yearly donations and funds from our various programs, in addition to the JTalks, which, by the way, I should have said you can play on this. Hashtag is CJFJTalk. In addition to these forums, the JTalks, we fund two websites, JSource and Projet J, which is a partnership with the Journalism Schools of Canada and some other organizations, which focuses attention on news about the business, but also analysis and a lot of self-help sections. One of our priorities as well is professional development through the Media Management Executive Program that we ran at Rotman. So tell your friends about us and keep coming back. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce a man who has one of the most important jobs in Canadian journalism at one of the cornerstones of our industry. Scott White has been editor-in-chief of the Canadian Press since 1997, and many of the news stories, as you know, the photos, the audio clips, and online content you see are produced by this amazing national treasure known as the Canadian Press. Scott oversaw the editorial transformation of the organization, integration of the print and broadcast divisions, and the introduction of CP's online video service. Prior to becoming editor-in-chief, Scott was CP's general news editor, chief of pictures, Vancouver bureau chief, Washington correspondent, sports editor, and Queen's Park correspondent. Scott is chair of the National Newspaper Awards Board of Governors, a member of the School of Journalism's Advisory Council at Ryerson, and a member of the International Olympic Committee's Press Commission. Ladies and gentlemen, a great friend of CJF and an industry leader, Scott White.
Thanks very much, Bob. It's great to be here tonight, and it's going to be a fantastic evening, and I understand one of the quickest sellouts for any CJF forum, so it's great to see everyone here. The title of tonight's discussion, Gutenberg's Last Stand, has a certain fatalistic ring to it. And as General Custer found out, last stands don't usually end well. A last stand is the final battlefield tactic employed only when all hope is lost. It's a last resort where the combatants decide that honor and integrity are more important to their cause than surrender or retreat. I have the great pleasure in my job at CP of knowing all these panelists, both in a professional, and I consider them all of them my friends, and I can attest that they are indeed fighting a 21st century newspaper war with honor and dedication, but they are showing no signs of retreating. And I suspect you'll hear from them tonight that they don't for a minute think that this is any kind of a last stand for newspapers. The newspaper war that they are fighting isn't only against each other. They're fighting a true guerrilla war. Who or what is the competition? News is not only ubiquitous, it's inescapable. If you happened to walk tonight from the subway or came in through the underground, you would have passed traditional newspaper boxes selling one of the city's four dailies. But you also would have walked by newspaper hawkers giving away free newspapers, TV screens turned to all news networks or all weather networks or all sports networks or all business networks, and giant outdoor screens like the one behind us pumping out stock prices and news headlines. If you take an elevator in this building, like I have, from the ground floor up to the top floor, you'll have enough time to read at least half a dozen stories in the little screen above the door. And I don't know what it's like in the women's washrooms, but right now in the men's washrooms, they even have screens above the urinals. It truly is inescapable. Your phone can literally put a world of news in the palm of your hand. Tablets, as we found out, only enhance that experience with incredible multimedia stories. There are more eyeballs reading more news stories on more platforms than any time before. So you would think that Gutenberg would be thrilled, because getting the news has never been easier. But that reality, as we all know, has also created a conundrum. Society now equates the pervasiveness of news with the idea that news is a commodity. The term commodity news suggests that anyone can produce news stories, that it's simple and inexpensive. And anyone in the business knows that that's not true. But when we as an industry start using the term, which we have, then we are promoting the idea that there's little value to what we do. I have a couple of friends from CP in the audience tonight, and they're going to have to suffer with me through this next thing, because anytime I ever hold a staff orientation or an editorial training meeting at Canadian Press, I always start my presentation with the following slide, which I think is going to come up. As most of you know, I'm sure you've read the book. This quote comes from the 2001 book by Bill Kovach and Tom Rosensteel called The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. And all that book is now more than a decade old. It still rings true to the challenges facing our panelists today. Kovach and Rosensteel also wrote the following. The definition of journalism has been exploded by technology, so now that anything is seen as journalism. Technology has created a new economic organization of journalism in which the norms of journalism are being pulled and redefined, and sometimes abandoned. But they remind us the purpose of journalism should not be defined by the technology. The purpose of journalism is to provide people with the information they need to function as a free society. And for society to remain free, it will need to pay for our news one way or the other. I suspect the business end of journalism is consuming our panelists to an extent their predecessors could have never imagined. Paywalls, video strategies, apps, custom content. We want to hear all about it tonight. So let's find out not only how our panelists are going to save the newspaper business, but save democracy and our free society as well. Not much pressure. I'm only going to spend a moment introducing our panelists because I think all of you know who they are, and the official biographies are in the program. I'm going to give you my, as I say, I know all of them, and I've worked with them for a long time. John Stackhouse is one of the greatest foreign correspondents that Canada has ever produced. He's brought that worldly outlook to the Globe and Mail as its editor-in-chief. The Globe invests in strong international and national journalism and has had an aggressive digital strategy that will enter a new stage next Monday when the Globe puts up its paywall. We're anxious to hear John's views on that and the other ideas the Globe has on its agenda. Lou Clancy is quite simply a great newspaper man. Under his current role as Vice President of Editorial for Post Media, he oversees the editorial operations for a great, iconic newspaper chain. I first met Lou when he was the ME at the Star more than 15 years ago, and since then he has been with Sun Media, The Record in the Waterloo region, and with Osprey Media. And here's what I know about Lou. Every place he's worked, he has made the newspapers where he was worked better. And he's certainly doing that now at Post Media, both in print and online. The only sad thing for Lou is the Yankees are losing 6-1 tonight. I first met Charlotte Empey a few weeks after she became editor-in-chief of the Metro English newspapers. And what a success story the Metro newspapers have become. Under Charlotte's enthusiastic guidance, the chain has expanded. And can you imagine that? Newspapers actually expanding to 10 different print editions and 15 digital sites. Charlotte comes from the magazine side of the business, and that background is part of the reason why Metro is such a success with some key demographics, which I think she may tell us about tonight. Michael Cook may have grown up on Fleet Street, but he has come to personify everything that is great about the Toronto Star. Both he and the paper are controversial, brash, sometimes outrageous, but always striving to give a voice for the voiceless. There is no news organization in this country that does investigations like the Star. And I don't know about you, but I often race to my breakfast table to see what magic Michael has done with A1, because no one does front pages like Michael Cook. These are our panelists. Please welcome them. So the format tonight is they're all going to speak for about 5 minutes. I'm going to start off with some questions, and then we will come to you in the audience for your questions. John, I'll turn it over to you.
So Thanks, Scott. And let me, before I start, say it's wonderful to see CP back in fighting form, and a great credit to you and many people at CP for hanging in there and keeping up the great fight that we all need you to win. I'm glad to be here for a bunch of reasons, but among the top of them is, like Lou, I'm also a Yankees fan, and I'm glad to see they scored finally, but the season can't end fast enough. As Scott was saying, we're launching a paywall next Monday, and I want to devote these few minutes to kind of walking you through that and what I think it may mean for journalism. Let me start by telling you what the journalist reaction, certainly at the Globe, has been to the idea of a paywall. And there's essentially two reactions. One is, thank God. And that's followed by, oh my God. So on the thank God side, it's journalists saying, finally, someone's going to pay for my travel bills, or someone's going to, it means no layoffs. This keeps us going. Thank God we can just keep going. And then the oh my God reaction comes, seems to be largely from columnists, but people who fear they're going to lose their audience. They won't have the same size of crowds and influence as they had before. And unfortunately, I hope we've worked through this at the Globe, but I fear a lot of journalists are missing the point of digital subscriptions. It's not about saving journalism. This is not a last stand fight by newspapers. It shouldn't be. This is a fantastic opportunity for all of us. I just got to spend a few days with Google in the US, and it was mind-blowing to see how they see the world and how they see opportunities everywhere. If you talk about energy, there's no energy crisis for Google in the world. The world is abundant in energy. There's no water shortage. Planet Earth has tons of water. There's no land shortage because there's something called outer space, and they think we need to be exploring that more. So there's just these brainiacs who are always thinking, if everyone's looking that way, how can we look that way and find an opportunity that others are missing? So if they were here tonight, they would say, there's no crisis in journalism. There are more human beings who are hungrier for better information than ever before. There's no crisis there. You guys have to wake up and figure out how to take advantage of that enormous demand and how to monetize it. And digital subscriptions is one very good way of doing that. We got to this point of a paywall through a long journey at the Globe. Of course, we've had digital subscriptions for a very long time. We have something called Globe Investor Gold, which has between 15 and 20,000 subscribers and has been running for over a decade, people paying $15, $16 a month, very loyal to us, very little turnover. It's been a tremendous success. So this notion that this is something new for the Globe is a bit misguided. We tried something before, a more traditional paywall called Globe Plus a number of years ago that didn't work so well, and I can speak a bit to that. And we also have something called Globe To Go, which is a tablet product. So it's not the desk. But we wanted to do something a bit more ambitious, and it really started a couple of years ago in 2010 when a group of us started to survey what was going on in media around the world. We first looked at doing a niche product, and this would be not a surprise to many. We were going to put a price on ROB content online and see if we could pull that off in Canada. That was a reasonably good prospect for us, but then we started to noodle what we could do with the iPad, because 2010, 2011, iPad sales were really starting to take off, and we devoted a team full-time to developing a whiz-bang Globe iPad product, which was pretty fantastic. We took that to market, and people said, that's really fantastic, but they weren't going to pay for it. So we went back to the drawing board and developed the ROB product a bit more. And then coming into this year, we were ready to go with a full-on ROB subscription product and took that back to our readers, both our long-term readers, the hardcore Globe readers and casual readers, and discovered there was a great willingness to pay for great journalism that was added with a great experience. And I don't want to lose that message. Great journalism plus great experience. And we decided this spring, hey, let's not limit it to the ROB. Let's do it for the whole Globe. So what had changed, even in a couple of years, were a few things. One is consumers. There's a much greater openness, willingness among consumers to pay for things online. Of course, most people still expect, especially information, to be free online, but there's a much greater willingness for consumers, especially sophisticated consumers, to pay for something of value online. You don't need to convince them of the idea of paying. Secondly is the industry trends. You're seeing around the world hundreds of newspapers, the greats, the New York Times, Financial Times, of course, has been charging for years, the Telegraph, the LA Times, now the Chicago Tribune, all moving down this road, and we were able to learn a lot from them, especially on the back end. And the third big change is technology. And for anyone thinking of developing a subscription model, please be aware that technology is the greatest challenge. IT and customer service are far more challenging than the journalism. I think I've got the easiest job among the Globe executive in bringing this project to market, because the IT challenge is Herculean, and customer service is also going to be a lot of fun next week when people start calling in by the thousands saying, I want to sign up, but I can't figure it out. Please walk me through that. So we've actually gone out and spent a lot more than we originally budgeted to hire call centers to manage that expected inflow. So market change, industry change, technology change. The meter, if you haven't read, is pretty simple. You can get 10 stories for free if you come to the Globe regularly and then have to sign up for a subscription after that. But the real secret sauce, not really a secret, but the juice that we're adding to it is exclusive content for business readers, because we feel we can build a strong base off of business readership, and special offers. So again, people want more than just the journalism. They want access. But then lastly, what they want most of all is a great user experience. So we've built in something called Globe Dashboard, which essentially allows people to build reading lists and get alerts around things that matter to them. We heard over and over and over again, maybe no surprise here, but people are overwhelmed with information today. They just cannot cope with the avalanche of information. And if you can provide them any help to cope with that, they're willing to pay a pretty good chunk of money for that. That's what we'll roll out next Monday. What does it mean to journalism? Let me share a few thoughts before I wrap up. The biggest point, which I've been stressing in the newsroom, is not a lot. We just need to continue to produce great, original, compelling, wonderful stories, as I hope we've been doing for decades, but we need to do that more than ever. We do need to continue to find different ways of telling stories, more video, different forms of stories, as well as great long-form stories. A few changes, though, that journalists do have to come to grips with, in my view, are... that may be the desk, but I'm wrapping up here. One is to be open to working with all departments. And this is a big leap for some journalists. But the journalist of the 2010s is someone who is quite comfortable working with the marketing department, working with the IT department, working with engineers to create great journalism, working with the audience unit, if you've got an audience unit, to understand what people want and when they want it. Secondly, understanding that the clock and calendar are much more important in journalism today. We're not a once-a-day activity anymore, and we need to be in the market of journalism when our readers want us to be in the market. And that's uncomfortable in some newsrooms that tend to start a bit later in the morning and like to go into the evening because they're pulled by that wonderful magnetic pole of the next morning's newspaper. Well, for us, most of our readers are on our site early in the morning, and they want fresh journalism then, so we've recalibrated the newsroom to meet that. And then lastly, to have a real understanding of audience, and we've created a unit within the newsroom. We've got a marketing and audience intelligence department, but we've also created an audience unit in the newsroom to help, made up of journalists, to help journalists understand what our readers, especially our paying readers, want, when they want it, how they're coming to your story. Are they coming from search, from outside the site, from within the site? What sections are they moving from and to? And help journalists understand that this isn't a random activity that we're in of journalism, and we need to have a much deeper relationship with our readers. Let me leave it there. I think my 5 minutes is up, and I'll be happy to take your questions.
Lou Clancy. Lou, it's 7-1. Just check. Okay, I am in mourning. Bill Schiller, who I haven't seen here in several years, walked in today. What's he say to me? Does he say hello? Does he shake my hand? No, he says 6-1. Thank you, Bill. However, I won't declare Gutenberg dead or even on his deathbed. Instead, I see him more as the bionic man, a man hit by a maelstrom of bad press, a bunch of social media engineers put back together with tablet arms, mobile eyes, online legs, and retained the print torso. In today's lexicon, he is platform agnostic. We just got to figure out how to pay for him. I'm not going to get into the litany of bad news that we are all too familiar with. Our constant bleeding about the industry is tiresome and in danger of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. At Postmedia, we believe there is a future in newspapers. It is a future that embraces all these parts and treats them as one. Our goal is to engage audiences on whatever platform they want. Over the last couple of years, our newsrooms have been transformed to reflect a digital workflow with considerable investment in new technologies. There is more work being done, especially in how we approach content in the non-print platforms. We have consolidated skills such as pagination and indeed editing and selection of non-local content to both, one, allow newsrooms to focus on local content and content creation, and two, yes, reduce legacy costs. Journalism, though, is not a legacy cost. It is our past, present, and future. Around the world, journalism is flourishing. Yes, we need more investigative and enterprise reporting, explanatory and local national content. We need more and better video. We need to better use social media. We need dynamic infographics. We also need to pay for these skills and tools. On the national side, Postmedia has brought in strong voices, such as Andrew Coyne, Christy Blatchford, Michael Dentant, Stephen Mayer. We have bolstered our old Ottawa Bureau and created an investigative unit. It's all pretty traditional stuff, right? Boring. Here's some new stuff, which reflects our changing culture and a culture that embraces failure and learns from it. We don't have all the answers. If we did, I'd be having dinner tonight with Bill Gates, not standing here. We are encouraging and leading innovation. Two examples. 4 months ago, we set up what we call Postmedia Labs in a funky bear house office at Sherbourne in Richmond. It is downtown because lab head Duncan Clark, raise your hand, Duncan, felt it was critical that these projects have a startup mentality, or at least to be no closer to Don Mills' Read Me than Google Hangout. Our hypothesis is that everyone has expertise in something. Our mission is to inspire these people to share this expertise, creating communities of interest. This expertise is validated by printing it in the newspaper, a win-win for us. So far, there are two projects tapping into this expertise. One is gastropost.com, a foodie site here in Toronto. The other is Capital Ideas, a site for small business entrepreneurs based in Edmonton working with the Journal. Each has a small staff drawn from outside the newspapers. Check into gastropost.com. Take one of Duncan's missions. The worst you can do is get a good meal. Here are some learnings from this project. One, including people's ideas in the newspaper absolutely provides personal validation, absolutely. In many ways, this is getting back to the heart of what newspapers were once seen to be, integral and active participants in the community. Community is just redefined. By the way, we have testimonials to this effect. Three, social media means reaching out directly, not expecting people to come just because you're in the space. Four, an engaged audience responds to deadlines. Five, thinking like an entrepreneur means moving at an entrepreneur's pace. Don't talk, do. Duncan can tell you things that they've tried that were abandoned on the very same day. They measure everything. It allows you to fail fast. It's supposed to be hard. That's just number seven. There is no religion. It's good to have everything you think you know put to the test. Eight, small teams, small bets, small batches equals big learning. Do we have time for a couple more?
Yes, sir.
In Vancouver, The Sun launched a Chinese language site. Tianbu Bao, whatever, fed by some translated Sun content, local bloggers, and a Chinese language service. 8 months after the launch, it's garnered 400,000 daily unique visitors, has a total of 13.5 million page views, and is already profitable. The province this month launched Vancouver Desi, an English language site for the lower mainland's huge South Asian population. It has already been linked to 9,000 times by such prominent sites as the Drudge Report, New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. It has almost 200,000 uniques and has more than a half million impressions. Learnings from these sites and from Duncan's projects will be shared across a network. And for your information, Duncan will be the one taking questions on these sites after the. Thank you.
Thank you, Lou. Charlotte?
Good evening. I'm really delighted to be here this evening to have an opportunity to share with you the sorts of conversations that we're having at Metro these days about where we are, where we're going. I think everyone in this room knows that our business, our profession, is in a state of flux. That said, I think it's a really exciting time to be a journalist, especially if we focus less on trying to renovate what is and instead ask ourselves what could be. How would we deliver news to our audiences if we were starting from scratch tomorrow? To that end, I thought I would share the conversation that we have been having, and I would start by talking a little bit about where we are. I think, as you probably all know, Metro is Canada's largest and fastest growing free daily. We're a national newspaper with almost 1.6 million readers daily, but we operate under, I think, a rather unique editorial structure. We publish the paper in 10 markets from Halifax to Vancouver, and we have a managing editor and reporters in each of those markets. They focus on local news. In fact, close to 30% of any given issue is local news. My teams in each market are the face of Metro. The readers in Winnipeg really aren't interested in Charlotte Empey. They are interested in Alicia Dacey, and they know her well because she's the managing editor of their paper. The national, international, and business news, as well as the life and entertainment content, is common across all our markets. The copy editors in Toronto build the papers for all markets, and the files are sent to local printers. Sometimes we're content aggregators, but increasingly, we're offering unique content created by Metro staff, as well as exclusive content provided by Metro World News. That's part of the managers of the Metro papers, which are published in 20 countries around the world. And thanks to those international affiliations, we have, for example, had exclusive pictures of the Greek earthquake and exclusive interviews with the Chilean miners. We are a national newspaper, but we have a very distinct local profile. So as you can imagine, our challenge is recognizing the psychographic profile that is common to all Metro readers, whether they live in Halifax or in Vancouver, while at the same time understanding the differences between our readers in each of those markets, and ensuring that we maintain our brand profile and personality and meet the unique needs of readers in each market, and sometimes that's a tall order. We've spent the last couple of years consolidating our editorial teams, focusing on the print product and raising the bar in terms of breaking stories, delivering unique content, ensuring there is a surprise and delight component in every issue, and putting new processes and policies in place to up the ante in terms of quality. Add to that the fact that we launched two new markets in 2011, London and Winnipeg, and two new markets in 2012, Regina and Saskatoon, and I think it's fair to say that we are perhaps one of the few newspapers in growth mode. This past spring, with the papers in a position of strength in every market, we turned our attention to digital. We relaunched our website and mobile apps on Android, iPhone, and iPad. We hired digital reporters, restructured the digital team in the Toronto office, and hired two newly created positions, National Deputy Editor Digital, an Associate Managing Editor, Digital. Our National Deputy Editor, Quinn Parker, came to us from The Guardian Online by way of Canada.com. Irene Kwan, our Associate ME, came to us from Reuters. Both have worked almost exclusively in digital news, and I think we've benefited enormously from their experience and their commitment. All this digital growth reflects a focused strategy. Metro is not a digital-first media company. Rather, we believe that our audience is looking for a seamless transition from the paper to mobile to online and back, depending on the time of day and what they're interested in discovering. And that each medium is valuable because each medium has specific strengths in its ability to tell stories. I come from print, so I think stories in print can go into really rich detail, and they can use language to paint very vivid pictures. That same story online can become experiential thanks to interactive maps, infographics, sound, video, photo galleries. Let me tell you a really simple story that I think was pivotal to a new appreciation we have of the way the same story can be told differently and effectively in print and online. Several years ago, our Vancouver staff ran a story about a convenience store that was attempting to dissuade teenagers from loitering around the front door. So the owner installed a mosquito buzzer at the entrance that emitted a buzzing sound that could only be picked up by young ears. This is right hand, I'm telling you, only young ears. When we ran the story online, we embedded the sound so readers could hear it or not hear it for themselves. The takeaway, our story meetings need to include discussions about how we will cover paper-only stories, online-only stories, and how we will cover stories that will run across all of our platforms. The paper does not drive digital, and digital does not drive the paper. The platforms work in partnership, and I think this is really important, to deliver stories that capitalize on each medium's strength and enhance the reader's experience. We talk a lot at Metro about what the future might look like, and here, conceptually, is where we're landing. Our readers will start their day by going to Metro online while they enjoy their breakfast. They'll discover what happened overnight in their cities, in their country, and around the world. They'll get local weather, perhaps important road or transit information, maybe some entertainment, interviews or video, music, all content that reflects the Metro personality. On the way to the bus or the streetcar, the LRT or the subway, they'll pick up their copy of Metro, which will be first to market with the stories behind the headlines, moving yesterday's stories forward, or unexpected stories, unexpected news that the readers didn't know they needed or wanted to know until they picked up their Metro. Throughout the day, Metropolitans on the go will check out Metro online on their smartphones, on their tablets. They want the latest news, information, breaking stories, gossip, sports, and that's what they'll get. On the way home, they'll turn to their smartphones or their iPads again, but the content mix will be different. They're finished work or school, and they want to unwind before their evening starts. So we think that what the readers are looking for at that point in their day is me time pursuits. Sure, there'll be the news, but perhaps there'll also be videos or serialized books or restaurant reviews or event listings. We're exploring what the content mix should be, on which platform, at what time of day. We're also spending a lot of time talking about social media, as I think everyone here is, because we understand that social media networks are big sources of instant news for our psychographic. Social media matters to them, and we need to figure out what that means to the way Metro engages readers on social networks. Metro readers are information junkies. They like to know about stuff before everyone else. But their definition of news is really broad. In fact, news, to my reader, is whatever it is they didn't know. So I think we need to stop defining what is news by today's standards and what newspapers are and what newspapers do and what digital is and what digital does. I think we need to take our cues from our audience. What is the impact of Metropolitans using social media to go directly to a story, bypassing metronews.ca homepage? It means every story page is a front page and needs to be treated as such. Metropolitans go to mobile when they're bored. So what's the implication of that? Content must be fresh, it must be entertaining, it must be compelling, and for my market, it must be clever. Our readers are self-absorbed. I expect that they would like to personalize their news to get more of what they want and less of what they don't want. So how would that work? Perhaps Metropolitans could create My Metro across all platforms as a personal, engaging, and interactive experience. And I can tell from the look on your face, you're all asking yourself, okay, Charlotte, and how is Metro going to make money on your vision of the future? And I'm going to be the first to tell you that I don't know. But I do know that if Metro allows readers to easily get what they want, when they want it, if we offer unique and exclusive content, if we make Metro an indispensable part of their day, they will be back all day, every day, and my Cracker Jack president and sales team will figure out how we're going to make money on that.
Michael.
Well, one of the problems with going last is that you're in danger of repeating and perhaps even worse, agreeing with what everyone has said. So I hope we're going to get into some disagreements later and not, and that'll be your job, Mr. Chairman, okay? So Scott has asked me to talk about business plans for digital, and the title is Gutenberg's Last Stand. I'm going to address that in the next 5 minutes. So Star, like everybody else, has had a website for 15 years. And like everybody else, we've been unable to make a digital business case. We haven't made a penny. We've got some revenues, but we haven't made enough money to even cover the costs of the newsroom, of our journalism. And now newspapers across North America and Europe are falling over themselves to put up paywalls. And that's, to be honest, that's been a recent hit with investors, especially in the United States, where newspaper stocks on the announcement of paywalls are squirting up. And that's a vote of confidence for our journalism and for our business. So, clearly, it's very welcome. We need it. So there are newspaper paywalls everywhere. A lot more are coming. But the truth is, we didn't just have a conference call a few months ago and all agree that paywalls are the way to go. There are two reasons, in my opinion, that we're going forward with paywalls now. One, as John Stackhouse hinted at or talked about, the relatively recent development of website metering technology that means, as I'm sure you know, that we can charge different readers different amounts for different content. And that's not new for newspapers. We've been doing that for 100 years or more with our different print subscription pricing from, you know, where we send it and who buys it. And the other reason that we're going for paywalls in such a rush, seems to me, is because of the downward pressure on CPMs, on the cost per thousands. And that's a real anvil on our business. And if you Google today, you'll see that Google is facing the same problems that we're facing. It's the question of new media meeting old media advertising problems. Anyway, as an industry, we've decided to charge people for our journalism, and I really like that. But it also includes, and I think for the foreseeable future will include, a very strong and perhaps, I think, probably dominant print partner. Because even a metered newsroom going forward, as the one that the Globe is doing, I can't see how that will pay for the newsroom. It's unclear how much money there will be, and it won't be unclear forever. And it's clear also that there are millions of dollars to be had, but I don't know how much. But I'm pretty sure that we won't be able to turn off print and go to digital anytime soon. If you're a Wall Street Journal subscriber, you pay about $270 a year for your subscription. A digital subscription there costs you about the same money, but with dramatically lower costs, obviously, for the Wall Street Journal. So it's big, big margins on digital subscriptions. The good news for papers like the Wall Street Journal and the Globe and Mail is that the current research shows, as John said, people will pay for quality. They really will. And the New York Times, what they've been doing for the last year, is an excellent demonstration of that. But you wouldn't think that, and we're going to talk a little bit later about social media, you wouldn't think that if you read the comments at the bottom of John Stackhouse's story announcing his paywall. Okay? There were 2,000-plus comments on that at the bottom of John's column, and every single one of them said a variation of, I aren't going to pay. Well, the fact is the Globe has done its homework, I'm sure, just as we've all run the numbers, and the research clearly says that enough people will pay to bring the Globe millions of bonus dollars. We've run the numbers, as I said. what would it cost to shut down the print edition and go digital? When might we be able to do that? And the truth is, there is no business case right now for doing that. And I honestly don't see one in the foreseeable future, which, given my age, is probably the next 4 or 5 years. Print remains vital. Now, everybody knows our challenges. And the financial crisis that began, I think, in around 2008, here's what I think. I think that financial crisis has beaten us up financially just as much and probably more than the structural changes that we're dealing with. And here's our problem. Newspapers historically have followed the economy. Economy's up, revenue's up. Economy's down, revenue goes down. Up until about two cycles ago, when something severed in our business and when the economy came back, newspapers didn't come back. And when our economy right now recovers from this dreadful state that it's in, I don't think we're going to get the money back either. In fact, it might even get worse. So that's why, you know, we've lost 50% of our advertising revenues. Newspapers in general have lost 50% of their advertising revenues in the last 8, 9, 10 years. Now, most industries that lose 50% of their income will be out of business. We're not out of business because of our profit margins have been historically high. Our return on revenues has been 20% plus. It's been 30% in some places. At the Calgary Herald, one of the newspapers, it's been 40%, and I think it's going to be 40% again, and that's something we might talk about later. Supermarket margins are around 2%, and if they'd be dead if what had happened to us had happened to supermarkets. So we're okay, but only because history's been really good to us. There's a lot of life left in print, so much, and if we're smart, we can come up with new and previously unimaginable ideas to make money in print. I'm going to give you three that happened at the Star. All three of them actually come from our VP of Circulation, Sandy McLeod. The Star gets millions of new dollars a year from its simple insertion of a slim version of the New York Times World Stories in our Sunday paper. People pay for it. They pay for quality. That's a great thing for us, and it brings us a lot of money. We now charge for home delivery of Star Week, the TV listings book. We used to give that like everybody else. Give it away on Saturdays for free. We now charge, and we previously delivered 600,000 of those. Now we have 250,000 people all paying 50 cents each for that little magazine. And we save big money on not having to print the other 350,000 copies for the people who clearly don't want it. That's new money, and you can do the math on that. And the last example of forward thinking in legacy media and legacy business, there's no doubt we've been forced to do it, is this. The Star has given the Globe a big mutual kiss. We've given the Globe, we're in partnership with the Globe now, we've merged our home delivery operations together. It makes no sense that we have two companies with lots of people driving around the city at 4 a.m. One delivers the Globe, the next one delivers the Star. You might as well have one company delivering both. That's what we've done. The savings are right in the back pocket, and there'll be millions of dollars by the time we've done. So is this Gutenberg's last stand? I don't think so. I think with business imagination and smartness in legacy media and in digital media, there's never been a better time to be a young journalist, a young reporter in this city. One generation ago, 20 years ago, there were three daily newspapers in this town. Today there are 8, plus all the websites, plus all the things that surround that. It's a great time to be a young reporter. So I'll leave that with you.
Thank you, Michael. So the format is that I'm going to throw a couple of questions out, probably for about 15 minutes or so, and then we will turn it over to the audience. I'll give everyone sort of a 5-minute notice when we're going to take questions from the audience. I have a very short, simple, but maybe not that simple question. What is your competition? Who is your competition today?
Google.
Google?
AOL. Yahoo.
John?
Although Google, I'd say they're also our friends, right? They're bringing us readers that in all sorts of ways. Competition is everywhere. It's for us, the people on stage here. It's blogs. It's niche publications. It's international publications. We're all in a fight, not just for readers. Our greatest fight is for people's time and attention. So, you know, we traditionally, newspapers traditionally had half an hour of someone's time on a weekday, and now no one has half an hour of anyone's time, and you're just trying to get some concentrated minutes with the audience that you want.
Charlotte, you talked about that your audience changes throughout the day, that the type of things they're doing. So do you have different competitors throughout the day, are you thinking of?
Yes, I think probably we do. Clearly for the printed product, other newspapers are Metro's competition to a greater or lesser degree depending on the market. Obviously online news sources, but for my audience, TMZ or HuffPost or Gawker is competition. I think social media is also competition. We know that Metro readers are getting news through social media, Facebook, Twitter, the blogs to a certain extent, but I think that landscape is changing. I think that increasingly bloggers are turning to outlets like Facebook because they can get a much larger audience for whatever it is that they want to say. So yeah, I think it's complicated, and I would absolutely agree with John that the overarching theme is that everybody is time-strapped, regardless of whether it's a Globe reader or a Metro reader, and with so many sources of information competing for my reader's time, because it's not just news, it's sources of information and how my reader defines news, it's tough. We have to work really hard to cut through that clutter and to capture the reader to what we're offering as opposed to what so many other places are offering.
Michael, I know that you want to disagree on some things tonight, and let me put this first one out there. Tell me that you still don't get a charge out of kicking the butt of one of these people up here. The Star exclusive, I see that sometimes three times on the front page. Who's your competition?
Well, you know, we like to think our competition's the Globe and Mail, but that's because we need somebody to come on the ice with us so we can put them through the glass. But the truth is, you know, as complicated as Charlotte says, and our competition is for people's attention and, you know, that share of mind and share of engagement on the many platforms that are around that when they fragment and fragment again. But the biggest competition, and Lou said this, are the folks at Google and Yahoo and the Huffington Post, whose business case rests solely on stealing our reporters' work and then making feeble excuses about why they're not really thieves at all and at the same time sitting in a bathtub of ad dollars they haven't really earned. So I regard those people as our competition too. And I don't think they don't do journalism, they don't do news. I mean, to be accurate, the Huffington Post does have reporting strength in Canada. At the beginning of this week, they had two reporters, one in Toronto and one in Ottawa. And the Star this week hired their entire Toronto staff. I also want to say this, you know, I've been thinking a little bit about the CBC and the CBC local websites. And I truly don't understand across this country, mostly attacking newspapers, where you have a CTV local news show, which nobody watches, and they're crying, poor, we don't have enough money, and yet they have these local news sites in direct competition with the two newspaper websites in Calgary and Edmonton. And they've even launched a website in Hamilton where they don't even have a TV show nobody watches. I think that's an important thing for us to get to grips with because they don't have a profit imperative. Their websites are spectacular because they're with taxpayers' money, but I don't see how that fulfills the CBC mandate.
John, you and I have talked about the CBC, that very point. I know it's something that you've raised yourself about the competition from CBC, which is a tremendous news organization that has tremendous resources.
Yeah, think how best to approach this. It irritates me, maybe more than it irritates Michael, that we're up against taxpayer-funded journalism in areas that have an abundance of journalism. And they get to do things, they get to go places. I had a CBC correspondent contact me recently, actually looking for a job, and they were in a place writing exclusively for CBC's website, because there was no TV interest in it, and they were in a place that we couldn't afford to send someone to. That's an interesting challenge. But we do need CBC journalism. I'm not saying it should be eliminated, but the CBC, in my view, has to come to grips with its mandate, and it shouldn't be everywhere in Canada. It should not be doing journalism actively where the private sector is doing good journalism. Toronto and many areas, sports, business, political news. There's an abundance of really good private sector journalism in this country. So the public sector provider, which the CBC should focus its resources on areas that are underserved.
I bet you that's a whole other topic that we could go on for. I'm giving you, giving Natalie and Wendy a topic for another night. Does the culture of your organization, and I don't mean only your newsroom, does it impede or facilitate the ability to change? Lou, you've done tremendous change in your organization. How's the culture been with throughout the organization in getting the changes?
Well, it's been like pulling teeth. It's been very difficult. I'd say that there's been huge cultural change, though, and it's getting easier each day. John referred to working with other departments. Well, that was an anthem in my day. At the Toronto Star, if advertising walked into the newsroom, they were under threat of bodily harm. That has changed quite a bit now, and we work with marketing. We're doing audience development with marketing. We discuss projects in advance sometimes with advertising, not to affect the content, but to see if there's anything we can do there in terms of sponsorships. Apologize. Thank you. Where was I? I got probably finished.
Okay. Charlotte, your staff is generally younger.
It's always younger.
But I know from dealing with many newsrooms across the country that that doesn't always mean that change is easy. How is it in your organization?
I may be incredibly blessed to say that making changes, plural, at Metro in my almost 3 years there has never been a problem. We really are a very lean and nimble organization, and our culture is one of being just a little bit rebellious. And I think that it's fair to say that any time editorially we have wanted to do something different or to try something, all I have to do is go to my president and put it on the table. We don't take break the bank risks because, you know, I'm old, I'm not that stupid, but if there's an opportunity to try things that look like they're going to work, then I get the go-ahead to make that happen. So I think perhaps I'm really lucky with my staff, because I suspect the average age is probably about late 20s. They are absolutely open to change, because for many of my staff, it's their first or perhaps their second job out of school, and they're so excited, and they are so full of what can be, that making change is not that difficult an issue.
Michael, tell us about change in the Star's newsroom, but also tell us about your feelings of change throughout the organization. You talked about how the website isn't essentially paying for itself. Are there cultural changes beyond the newsroom that are or are not adapting?
Well, look, I mean, am I good?
Yeah.
His history tells us everything, and what history tells us is that it's just about close to impossible for an established institutional business to reinvent itself or to go through a necessary paradigm shift. And I think Don Tapscott says in one of his books, that's why NBC didn't invent YouTube, and it's why AT&T didn't invent Skype, and it's how Blockbuster never discovered Netflix, and why didn't CNN invent Twitter, and why didn't Microsoft invent Google, and it's also why The Star didn't invent the Huffington Post. But I think it's fair to say now that, you know, we have seen the light, that there's a powerful digital ideology out there that keeps repeating that the mainstream media, that's us, we don't get it digitally, and we can't adapt to new ways of producing news. And I think that's just wrong. If you look at who's producing the news, has anyone in digital emerged and come out to do that work? You know, the work of reporting, of actually getting out of the office and finding and reporting the news and shining a light on the cockroaches? No. Google and Yahoo and the rest are basically engineering companies, and they do that very well, but they don't do news. The truth is, our reporters do their news for them. Now, we newspapers do get it digitally, and you can say it's been a long time coming, and you can say that, you know, should we change faster? And the answer to that is yes, yes, and yes. But we have successfully changed our digital operations, and we do digital reporting, but it's old-fashioned reporting in many ways, but we're using digital tools. I think there's nobody out there doing this deep and important work that we do that helps, I don't want to get too over the top here, but helps our democracy flourish now. It's only newspapers, both in print and digitally, that continue to do that. Nobody else is.
John, picking up on a point that Lou made, many newspapers are turning to custom content as a way to bring in new revenue. Is this something the Globe's doing? If it is, and for something for all of you to think about, what is your definition of custom content? And are you being transparent to the public in your use of it?
Yeah, it's a great question and a challenge for all of us. We're doing much more custom content, custom publishing. I suspect everyone is. It is the only significant revenue growth area right now in a lot of newspaper companies. And custom publishing comes in many forms, and often the debate gets a bit misguided because people don't differentiate between the forms. At its best, custom publishing is about context. So advertisers want a context. A mutual fund company wants its ads to be surrounded by content about mutual funds. So we produce special reports. We've been doing special reports for as long as I can remember, decades. Nothing really wrong with that. In fact, it allows us to do some niche journalism that we might not get to do otherwise. The great danger, and this is where we are not transparent enough, is that some media companies in this country they allow the advertisers to dictate what will be in the content. We don't allow that, and we've had a lot of internal battles over it, but we're adamant that the advertisers don't get to see the content produced by our newsroom. They don't get to dictate that one of their people will be quoted in a story. If they want to offer up someone, then that person may be interviewed, but we're going to interview a range of people. They don't get to dictate the terms of the content. That's different from advertorial. Advertorial is editorial content that's produced by the advertiser. So obviously they know what the content will be. There's a great debate, we're having it internally, and I suspect everyone else is, about labeling and about indicating that to the reader. The advertisers, of course, don't want the reader, or some of them don't want the reader to know the difference. And we're wrestling with designs, with labels, with fonts, those different cues, and need to continue to be transparent or be more transparent with readers to explain what the difference is.
Lou, is the question of transparency more difficult on the digital side when newspapers are in this area?
I don't think it's more difficult. I think it's the same issue. I think you have to be as transparent as possible. We've developed, I think it's 8 different labeling dictums right now, from pure advertising to marketing features to something that's sponsored by a company. I forget the label, but we're working very hard at that, and those same things apply to online. We want the reader, the audience, to know that if the company has seen the story, it's an ad. If they, you know, it's advertorial. We're very clear on it. The Post is very, very diligent in this, the National Post, in working on this and helped develop these labels for us.
I don't want
to. Can I just jump in? Because one of the challenges for us as an industry is that a lot of advertisers play us off against each other, and we have that at the Globe all the time. My ad department will come to me and say, "Well, organization X has just agreed to that, and you're saying no. They're going to take all their money to us." Fortunately, I've got a publisher who's willing to fight for the newsroom on that, but it's a challenge for everyone, and if there was a way for the industry to, show some more collective will, that would be good for journalism.
Wanted to move on to another question, but I'll give everybody the 5-minute notice that after this we'll open it up to the floor. I'm running a little bit late, but there's been some fantastic, but I wanted to ask this question. Social media has allowed the public to hold the media, the traditional media, up to the same light that we hold up other institutions. How has that public engagement changed how you run your newspaper? Charlotte?
I'm not sure that it's actually changed what we strive to do at Metro at all. I think that everyone in this room would agree that our job is to stand up for journalistic imperatives, and it's, in my mind, and certainly in my newsroom, I'm focused way more on, are we clear and secure that we are following the tenets of good journalism? I would like to think that anybody could take a look at what we do and would recognize that we are that we're journalists and we do it properly. I don't think that it's any different today with social media. I agree that if we had a challenge, it is easier for way more people to hear about it way faster, but that doesn't change the thing that if we had a challenge, you know, we're responsible for that. So for me, it just means that we are as vigilant as we would have to be without social media.
Michael, how important are the comments on as the stories are developing, and what other impacts social media have changed the Star's newsroom?
Well, look, I mean, I don't, if you read any of the comments on YouTube or any of the comments, there are most of them are nonsense. Many of them are racist, misogynist, stupid. You know, that's just what they are for the most part. You know, but when you ask the question, social media has allowed the public to hold the social media has allowed the public to hold the media up to the same light that we hold up to other institutions. Star doesn't duck accountability at all. I mean, we just don't. We have a public editor who's both public and active, and I think the question you posed is a biased question, incredibly biased, because I don't think anybody thinks that social media can be or is acting as any kind of an honest broker on the news. Social media doesn't operate the same way that we do, with the same skills, and certainly not the same ethics. And a lot of social media is anonymous shouting and insults, and it's essentially voices from the mob. And as you say, if you read comments on stories about institutions, I mean, do you really think those comments hold us to account the way that an investigative story might hold an institution to account? I don't think so. We have a checklist in our newsroom, as I'm sure you do, for our own fairness when we're putting stories together. And we also have a checklist that's been kindly provided to us by the Supreme Court of Canada, a checklist for fairness. Social media doesn't operate with a fairness checklist. Gawker's Nick Denton says that social media is a conversation and the conversation is more revealing than the news. Well, really? Go look at those comments and I think you'll disagree. Now, we have to listen to social media. We break stories and we spread our journalism using social media, but it's a tool. I don't think it's an honest broker.
John, what are your thoughts?
I'm just tickled that Michael read all 2,000 comments with my piece. That's impressive. You've got a well-run newsroom, my friend. When the editor can read 2,000 comments, that's terrific. I've got to learn from you.
He's got a good researcher.
let me share a story about a couple of our commenters, because we have it's mostly anonymous and a lot of slagging on our site, and we're continuously looking at our comment policy and how to improve the quality, as I suspect a number of newspapers are. There were two commenters, and we know who our commenters are because they have to register. Who were having a vicious back and forth, and Michael's description was not far off of these two people. And one of our community editors had to intervene, so she contacted both of them to say, you guys need to tone it down, and discovered one of them was a lawyer for a significant corporation in Eastern Canada, and the other was an executive for a major energy company. And these two guys, in the middle of a work day, are going back and forth over a serious issue and just using language. It wasn't that their debate was crazy, it's just their language was something we wouldn't publish. So we're trying to find a way to allow sophisticated readers like this, because often the assumption is, you know, these are trolls sitting in their parents' basement somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Maybe there's some of that, but there's a lot of really sophisticated people we found, and they want to comment, they want to participate, and we can learn from them. So what the way we're approaching it now, is it ideal? No, it's far from where we should be, but I don't want to give it up and lose that connection that we have with readers. So we need to find a more constructive dialogue with them. And if people have ideas, please please share them.
Lou, there must be value in engagement. Is there a business value? But if you look back at the history of newspapers, even back to Gutenberg, I think, it was all about getting people engaged in issues. Surely social media has done that, even when they criticize the work we do.
Well, yeah, it has to a degree. I mean, it's broadened that access to audience. Newspapers used to be able to say that they were the meeting place of ideas. Well, we're one of the meeting places for ideas now. But when it comes to, you know, I agree completely with the tone of a lot of commenting. We've been experimenting in Windsor with Facebook commenting, and in Edmonton with Facebook commenting, and we have found the level of dialogue has improved. I think if people are identified and not hiding anonymously, it changes the conversation. I don't like anonymous comments. I didn't like them before there was social media. If you got something to say, say it, but put your name to it. And I think if we take that direction, and that people we know who's speaking. We know it's a lawyer. In Halifax or whatever, I think that will improve the dialogue and be much more useful. And I also think you can gain from social media. I know that the Post at times will sort of self-correct a story before it hits print that's been put up online, because it looks at and monitors what kind of commenting it's getting.
I'm going to open it up. Do we have any questions? We'd like you to go to the microphone, and in the sense that we just talked about, please fully identify yourself. I'm also going to say something, not because I've been asked to, but I've been on the other side of the microphone many times at these. I enjoy questions. I don't enjoy speeches. We have about 20 minutes left, so we expect there'll be lots of questions tonight.
Jim Harris, my first journalistic job was the Whig Standard and then the Financial Post. The ad revenue in North America has fallen by two-thirds from 2000, according to the American Newspaper Association, to a point where now the search engine optimization business in North America is worth more than the newspaper business. This isn't Google. These are a bunch of diversified, tiny little companies that help other companies achieve higher Google search rankings. My scan of the Canadian media has been it has not gone into this as a business that's now larger than its own ad revenue. My question is why?
Who would like to take that first? Don't all jump at once.
Oh, hell, I don't know.
Thanks.
when I was at the Star when we all jumped into the online field, and at the time I fought bitterly with a fellow named Rocco Rossi. You may have recalled that he ran for mayor, but he headed up our online unit, and I said, why are we giving this stuff away? I think this is stupid. I think 15 years later I was right. Why isn't it a business? I can remember everyone across North America that had a newspaper saying, well, we don't know, but we got to be there. That isn't the way to run a business, no. But we got to figure that out. I think we will make digital a business. I think tablet and mobile provide the opportunities that those are going to happen in. I actually love tablets, and most of you probably have smartphones. I love my tablet. That I can read. I'm kind of old-fashioned that way. And I think there is a business that's going to be developed there, and it goes much beyond paywalls.
Michael, you touched on this topic earlier where you said you're essentially saying that as traditional we weren't innovative enough. It's easy to look back, but are we using, I've heard you say that most print newspapers are still making profits. John talked about the margin. Have we been smart in the last couple of years of actually investing in the future, where not just the newspaper business, but so many businesses in the Western world focus on quarter-to-quarter results? Are we investing in our industry?
Yeah. Well, the Star has a division that's run by the publisher, John Cruikshank, and its very existence is to do that, to launch businesses, to throw them out, see what happens, give them 2 or 3 years to go, and hope at the end of it you get $500,000 or $1 million in EBITDA from each of them. So there's a lot of that going on at One Yonge Street. On the SEO question, I don't know the businesses you're referring to, whether these are companies that come and teach you how to use SEO. Is that what you're saying?
They'll do it on, so if you're a manufacturer of widgets, you want to be in the top of the Google
ranking. Right,
you
right.
Pay this company to get you up there.
Right. Well, we, in fact, engage one of those companies in the newsroom to come and teach us about SEO. You know, the average, our SEO for our digital journalism was running at about 22%. That's how people were getting to the stories. And we needed it to be the industry average of about 31 to 35. I think it's about 31, 32 right now, so we've got a way to go. Well, that's just another example of how different it is to edit a newspaper. You know, you need to learn about and understand SEO. And you need to understand about Google, and you need to be able to seduce Google and understand Google and send Google flowers from time to time. And they give you, they reward you by moving your stories up on overnight Google. 2 years ago at the Toronto Star, a story on the Toronto Maple Leafs, if you Googled Toronto Maple Leafs, you'd get a story from the Brandon Sun or the Halifax Chronicle. The Star wasn't there. It's because we knew nothing, we hadn't learned enough about dealing with SEO. So now we do things to make Google lovers, and we've had some success. I'll give you one little tip if you want to increase your SEO for your newspaper or your company. Every time Google comes out with a doodle, phone their PR department and get them to tell you what it is, write a little story and put it on your website, and Google will love you probably for about 3 weeks.
Another question from the floor.
Hi, my name is Karen Ho. So newspapers are trying new things like GastroPost and the outfit that I work for, which is Your Mississauga Biz, which is this new business journal that's started by the Star Media Group to try and do something new. It's totally subscriber only. The thing is, experiments like this cost money, and in a lot of places, they barely have enough money to hire the new staff that they need to replace people on mat leave or people retiring. And it's very hard because a lot of the places that you work for are, you know, you have to account for investors and stockholders, and, you know, the quarterly reports come out every year, and you have to account for these in your conference calls. With this being said, I mean, how can you convince, you know, either your publishers or your stockholders and these investors to put forth this money and make these experiments and even take the risk on losing a little bit of money in the initial phase when you're trying things out and experimenting? Because there is so little money to go around and sort of make these expensive mistakes.
Charlotte, you've talked about when you have to go to your president to make a case for something. Is there room for error when you make those presentations?
Yes, there is. And I guess, again, because we are small and we're nimble, I think that Michael's comment earlier that the larger, more established organizations probably have a more difficult time with making change or taking the mothership in a slightly different direction. But that said, don't misunderstand me. It's not as if I can walk in to Bill's office and say, this is like such an incredibly cool, awesome idea. We seriously have to do it right now. Just give me whatever it is I need and we're going to make it work. No, I have to go in with a business case. I need to be able to show deliverables. I need to be able to explain the metrics by which we will assess whether or not this has worked or not worked. And sometimes, to be honest, my president says, that's a great idea, but you're going to have to find it in your budget. So I have to go back to my senior team and figure out how I'm going to move some money around, because we're convinced that this is going to be a good thing to do. I'm not sure that I've answered your question, because money is tight. Absolutely, it's tight. And the current business climate, the current revenue figures are not great for anybody in our business. but I think that sometimes that's the impetus to take a look at new opportunities, at new branded products, at opportunities to create something with a Metro brand that is not anything that we've ever done before, but it sits comfortably inside our brand personality and would live inside our portfolio. I would also never take an idea to, I wouldn't take it upstairs, well, it's down the hall, actually, it's not upstairs, if I hadn't already spoken to my VP sales or my ad director, because I would need to know that they're comfortable that there could be advertisers interested in supporting or coming on board in some fashion.
John, compared to the predecessors in your chair, when Eddie was there before Eddie, how much more time do you spend on business cases for new products compared to your experience at the Globe previously?
That's a great question. I'm not sure. I haven't looked through diaries of previous editors. I suspect it's a fair bit. I probably spend a third of my time on the business.
On the business
challenges,
side.
Whether it be business cases or other business challenges.
Right. Mm. And does that impede on your ability to worry about the journalism, or is that just expected in today's age?
No, it's easy because I've learned to live without sleep. So that's where the 8 hours come from. No, it's a challenge. I often wonder, am I, as editor, not focused enough on the journalism and on the floor? And I don't think I'm alone in that. Try to ensure I've got the right team to manage that. But that's a constant concern.
Lou, how do you feel about that?
I think that I'll use the Post as an example. The Post is run by a bunch of entrepreneurs. They find ways to get things done. Not everything costs a lot of money. Gastro Post is a very small staff. We have a strategic plan that our board has accepted that allows us to do these kinds of things, provided we do the due diligence that's been talked about. We aren't, we don't have a dozen projects going. We have a few going, and we are going to learn from them quickly. I was told when we started this kind of thing by a couple of guys that helped us set up Gastro Post to read a book called The Lean Startup. I suggest you all read it. It will answer a lot of those questions. You got to go as if your wallet's half empty, not that it's full, and make it work.
Michael, in your time at the Star, has it changed? The Star Media Group is a separate part of the organization, but how much of the, quote, business end of the newspapers do you devote your time to?
Not very much, to be honest. I spend most of my time in the newsroom. I have people to do that business worry stuff. We also have a separate, as I said before, a separate division that's launching new businesses, not all the time, but the Mississauga News is a good example. I think that launched last week. The Kit would be an example, although that was by acquisition. The Grid is another example that's doing really well. And there's about half a dozen Star Content Studios, which has been turned into a business to go out and find the very people that John was talking about and do work for them, advertiser-directed work. So we have to do that. But it's not a lot of money. But as an accumulation, it might be $10 million in EBITDA, 2 years from now. And given the way that advertising revenues are shrinking, and I only know the number for sure from Fairfax in Sydney and Melbourne, Australia, that they're predicting their advertising revenues will decrease at 15% a year compounded. So in 4 years, 5 years. It's already gone down 50% in 4 or 5 years. They got nothing left, and that's why if you go to Google and type in Fairfax, you'll see those horror stories of what those papers are doing to their businesses and to their newsrooms to get into the shape they think they need to be in to face the challenges going forward.
Jim Poling from the Hamilton Spectator has a question for us.
Thanks, Scott. There's been much talk of contemporary journalism and innovation. And Karen just talked about or mentioned hiring and staffing. I mentioned some of the attributes you look for in a contemporary and evolving journalist. And as a second part, are current J schools meeting those needs?
Charlotte, you've hired a fair number of people in different markets, and you've told me that sometimes it's a challenge. It's still a challenge to find the people in certain places. What do you look for?
We tend to hire, as I said earlier, grads or recent grads. What I look for is someone who has some sort of training and some sort of experience. So yeah, I'm looking for a J-school grad. In an ideal world, that person would have worked for a couple of years, perhaps on a small daily or a weekly newspaper, and Metro is the next step for them. I don't expect them, honestly, to stay with me until they retire. Well, clearly I'm going to retire long before they do, but I look at the experience. I want energy, I want enthusiasm, I want commitment. I want young people who are coming with great story ideas, who understand that my job isn't always to say this is the way it's going to be. The part of their job is to come back to me and say, what about? What if we did this? I've got this story idea. And I've been really lucky that in most of my markets, I have been able to find exactly those sorts of young people who are galvanized by journalism, who have stories that they know need to be told, and who want to be helpful in telling those stories. I think that the journalism schools, if the people I am hiring are any indication, are doing a really good job. I think that, I mean, I haven't spoken at a J school in some number of years, but the students that I'm getting have all of what I'm looking for, which is that combination of, yes, the training and the goods, they know how to get the job done, but that indefinable something that is, they're still really hungry and they get excited with their byline and they come racing back to the office when they've got a coup, and when we break stories, oh my goodness, it's like over the top. So it's good.
Michael, it's such a rarity now when we actually get to hire like a full-time staff person. What are you looking for?
I'll just address the question of interns, if I may, just from all the young people. The Star hired, a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, the Star hired 22 interns, and we pay them good money that'll be with us for about the next year. And I don't hire them, but I just see their work, and I they're fabulous young people. They come from a variation of J-schools, and some of them have been worked before, some of them have been out of the workforce. All of them are a little older than they used to be. They're now 25, 26, and not 22, 23. All of them usually speak another language. Certainly all of them have been somewhere else in the world. And when they come to the Star, I'm amazed truly just about every day when I pick up a story and see a byline on the front page that I don't recognize. And it usually turns out to be, in fact, always turns out to be a young intern. Those interns write the Star. They do the daily work day in and day out, and occasionally when we let them loose on something big, the way we sent Jenny Yang down to the Chilean miners' rescue, she wins a National Newspaper Award for interpretive reporting. So they're fabulous, these people. I don't know where they get them from, but they turn up in the newsroom, and they're great.
Somebody's doing something right. Another question from the floor.
My name is Lindsay Shaddy, and I'm a mere subscriber. I think it's great that you're finding good young people, and I'm all for a nice, healthy age mix of staff. But let me tell you, over the years, my perspective has been changed so many times by reading experienced, well-read people like Richard Gwynn, Andrew Coyne, Jeffrey Simpson. We still need mature people who've been around and know a few things and bring that background.
We're not in conflict here. We're not in conflict at all. I was answering the other question about young people. We're not in conflict.
Well, it's fewer and fewer, and I don't think it is a point of pride to say we all... I'm sorry I haven't been that riveted by Metro, which I sometimes see on a seat in the subway. But I guess I'm very... Metro's not for you, though.
You're not in Metro's demographic.
I'm very concerned about that very demographic, the dumbing down. Kids today don't even watch news on TV. They don't have TVs. Kids are getting these very short snippets of dubious value. And what are we going to do about the dumbing down? Who is going to be able to make our decisions in the future?
There are some extraordinary young journalists out there. We've been lucky enough to hire some of them. Michael and I have wrestled over some of them. One we've just hired, Kim McCrail, who you might consider young, is one of the most sophisticated journalists I've come across in recent years. So yeah, experience and age are good things, but I don't know what you define as young.
Young and well read too.
Absolutely.
Well read, knowledgeable.
Yeah. So what do we look for? Hunger, character, intelligence, and those are things you generally don't learn at J school. And I'm not saying J school is bad, but those are things that people tend to arrive at J school with. Actual skills, I don't worry too much about, because 3 to 5 years from now, who knows what skills we'll all need, but they'll be different than the skills we have today. So the intelligence, hunger, and character come into play. And I don't fret too much about age, because there are some fantastic 25-year-olds out there and some fantastic 65-year-olds out there who have the same attributes.
We're going to take one more question. I have permission to run over just a bit. One more question from the floor. Thank you.
Okay, this is way too much pressure to be the last question. My name's Sarah Miller. I'm a recovering journalist. My question is about your reader. And I don't mean we need readers to pay for news so we can give them news. I'm curious to know, in the 15 years since the websites really started, and in the last 5 since social media and blogging has changed things, how important is the reader in your coverage? It's no longer... You know, newspapers used to broadcast to their subscribers and their readers, and if you had a problem, you could write a letter to the editor. Maybe it got published, maybe it sat in a pile. But now readers can interact with us. How important is that interaction to you, whether on your site, on a social media site like Facebook or Twitter, or just do you just ignore it?
It's absolutely critical. You have to have an open discussion with your readers at all times. Social media has increased that ability. It's also brought some negative sides, obviously. But when we talk about audience development, that's who we're talking about. We're talking about readers. We're doing everything from psychographics to polling to surveys to online surveys to find out what they want, what they need, what their interests are. And what they think of us. And we no longer sit in an ivory tower. The pulpit has been removed. We have to sit down with them.
Charlotte, you have a very good idea of who your readers are. How important are your readers? It's a basic, excellent question to ask.
Well, clearly my readers are incredibly important. I mean, they're the reason why I get up and go to work and, you know, the reason I get to collect a paycheck. But I think that interaction with readers is incredibly important, because I think that the days are long gone when the media got to your point, got to say, here is how you are going to think about things. And my reader in particular, because we do 18 to 49, and clearly the woman who doesn't like my paper would not be in our psychographic, we're in the 18 to 49, with 25 to 34 being the sweet spot for us. What's really important is that I understand what they're interested in hearing about, and social media gives me a window into their world. I would disagree a little bit with Michael when he said earlier that it's a lot of noise and it's a lot of bias and it's a lot of, you know, wingnuts holding forth. I get that. But even the wingnuts holding forth are giving me a window onto a much larger world than I would have ever had if I weren't able to hear what they have to say, to think about what does that mean, and is that saying something about a larger number of people? What is the conversation that's happening out there? And if I don't know what that is, if I don't know what my readers are thinking about and talking about and tweeting about, then it's impossible for me to be able to put together a paper that we think will be interesting to them. When I started at Metro, I did lunch and learns across the country, and one thing that I took away that was incredibly interesting, if you'll allow me one more 30 seconds, the readers in Halifax, the readers in Vancouver, and everywhere in between told me something that was constant, different language, but a constant theme. They said, these are my readers I'm talking about and not the readers of my esteemed colleagues' papers. What they liked about Metro was it gave them the facts and let them make up their own mind how they felt about that particular issue. That was an important thing for me to understand if I was going to continue to create a newspaper and ultimately all of the digital products that was going to hear, was going to listen, wasn't going to say, here's what I think. about you, for you, with you, it's really a reflection of what it is they're telling me that they want to know, using the language and the method of conversation that they're telling me they want.
Michael, every story online can be measured. We all worry about trending stories. But Steve Jobs, and I'm going to probably butcher exactly what he said, but it was more or less, it's not, it's not the customer's job to tell us what they want. We tell them what they need. How has that impacted the ability to measure every single thing online impacted on news judgment, on pandering to the popular as opposed to the important?
Or giving people what they say they want and need. We have a big screen in our newsroom, and I'm sure you know about it, it's Chartbeat, and that tells us what people are watching at any given moment. So we adjust, and it really only affects the star.com. We adjust our journalism to match what we think people want to read. So in the morning, we'll look very quickly at what's trending on Twitter, what people are asking questions about, what's trending on Google. If IKEA chairs, because they're faulty or something, are trending on Google search, and we don't have a story on it, and people want to read about IKEA chairs, clearly, then we'll get one, and we'll put it on the web. We will change, because of those tools, we will change the star.com lineup almost hourly, based on what we learn from the variety of tools that we have.
John,
and it's a different way to be an editor. It's not right or wrong. It's just different.
Just different. John, last word. How is that type of decision making impacting on an hourly basis in the Globe's newsroom?
It's a balance that probably a lot of businesses have to find between your native intelligence and understanding of what readers will want when you get it to them. Steve Jobs was great at that, and listening to the mob, and never ignore the mob, but never be driven by the mob. Basic rule.
Right. I'm going to now turn it back over to Bob.
Scott and the panel, let's have a nice round of applause. Scott, you did a great job, and I'm grateful to all of you for the time you volunteered here this evening out of your busy day, so appreciate that very much. I also want to give a shout out to all the tweeters in the house, because I think we're trending. with a little bemusement about some of the acerbic comments about tweeters, by the way, which you can catch up to later this evening. I just want to thank once again BMO Financial for its wonderful support of this series of talks, and to Ipsos for the polling that they so generously have provided us with, and you can check it out on jsource.ca, a full report with all kinds of nice graphics. A reminder, our next JTalks event will be November 22nd, when a substantial journalist, Steve Paikin, is going to be a moderator of a panel of top broadcast executives from CTV Global and CTV. So with that, I invite you to join us for some refreshments and some further chat. Thanks very much.